Welcome, welcome. We are back for another episode of The Lock-In. I'm Pot Limit Omaha pro David Lappin. And joining me, as usual, is my fellow Unibet ambassador, Dara O'Kearney. Dara, welcome.
Thank you, David. I'm delighted and honoured to be here with such an esteemed PLO pro.
Well, not a heads-up pro, it must be said.
You haven't got to the heads-up section of whatever course you're learning PLO from at the moment. But once you do, I'm sure you'll start actually winning tournaments.
Yeah, three PLO heads ups in the space of about a week, and I lost them all. Anyway, joining us on this, the week of the WSOP Europe main event, is none other than a former WSOPE main event champion, a main event final tablist as well, an EPT London and Astralis Barcelona runner up. He is our good pal Jack Sinclair. Jack, welcome back to the show.
Howdy. Thanks for having me back. Always a pleasure.
It's great to have you back on the show, Jack. So let's start with the WSOPE main, I guess, which at the time of recording is down to six players. Italy's Simone Andrian, Irmo Velvet from Estonia, Maria Skilinski of Poland, former EPT champion Ranelani of Israel, Germany's David Hockheim and Italian Enrico Kamoski make up the final six. They're all guaranteed 200k and there is 1.3 million up top in this one. By the time it airs, this show, I should say, it is likely that there will be a champion crowned already. So let's do a bit of predicting. Maybe I'll look silly, maybe I won't. I honestly can't see past Simone Andrian for this one. You might know this guy, Jack, from the Merit Streets. I've commented on him many times at Merit, where he's made so many final tables in the last couple of years. He's a young guy who gets into these spots with big chip leads a lot of the time, and he does understand how to use it. And just the last 3 years, I'm just looking at his resume here, he has won the 1500 Six Max bracelet at WSOP, the WPT Prime San Remo, the PokerStars Summer Festival here in Malta. I remember that one. He won a huge flip four ways versus David Doherty, which basically clinched him that one. He also won a Six Max side event at EPT Prague and the Merit Western Series warm-up. That's a ridiculous bunch of wins in such a short space of time, just two and a half years there. Jack, have you been following this one?
Not in any great detail, but yeah, I know Simone and I know Enrico. I don't think I know any of the other players on the final table, just the Italians. Yeah, but obviously he's pretty sick heater to have won, what was that, six tournaments in 2 years or something, which is pretty improbable. And he's a huge chip leader, right, now, I think. So, yeah, obviously you would be foolish to bet against him at even money. But, yeah, I really can't say I know that much about his game. I've played with him a few times. He seems competent, but I can't really say I have any specific read on him at all. So I assume he's going to play well if he's doing that well, and you know, otherwise he'd have to be insanely lucky, but that is also possible.
There we go, Derek. Competent, that's high praise indeed from Jack Sinclair. do you want to make a prediction about this one?
Yeah, I was just about to say that for people who are unaware with Sinclair speak, competent is as good as it gets. Like we're all varying degrees of dreadful in Jack's world. So it's quite the compliment. I mean, to be honest, I haven't really been following it. So if you say this guy's on a heater and he's a massive chip leader, I'm certainly not going to predict anybody else is going to win. That would just seem pretty dumb. But yeah, I have to admit, I know nothing about it or this particular player either. I just haven't been following it. It seems to me like the WSOP has sort of slipped back in value. I mean, they used to get really high quality fields and, you know, produce great winners like Jack, for example. But it just doesn't seem to be the same hype or buzz around it anymore.
Yeah, it really peaked around 2018, I think.
Well, speaking of peaking around 2018 and speaking of people on a heater, Jack, you actually came on the chip race at very late notice, I remember, after your win in the WSOP Europe main back in 2018. It marked the first time that Dara hit someone with the somewhat depressing F. Scott Fitzgerald story about careers peaking too early. He has unloaded that one, by the way, on a couple of other guests since. You obviously did have tremendous success right away in the game of poker. How easy or hard has it been to motivate yourself since that extraordinary breakout year?
Motivation is not something that's that difficult, I think, in poker, especially if you're a live player. Like you just go to the stop and then you play. Like sometimes it's difficult to pick where to go, but pretty much FOMO does most of the work in terms of motivating you to keep playing. Like I'm not playing anywhere right now, which obviously is a bit unusual considering the World Series of Poker Europe is happening now, and I think the EPT Cyprus starts today or tomorrow or yesterday. So yeah, I mean, I guess you could argue that I'm a bit low on motivation now, but I consider myself semi-retired. I only play when I want to, so I'm not actually trying to force myself to do anything very much, and I play mostly when it's convenient and or I want to go to the stop. But at least for the last, I don't know, 5, 6 years since winning WSOP Europe, you know, I've played a pretty consistent volume of live stops, and you know, really the motivation since now is just to win something again, because it's been a lot of near misses since then, and really would like to get my hands on a trophy again, you know, at some point before I completely quit.
Well, Dara, picking up on what you said actually there a few moments ago, I know you and I have received some messages this week expressing surprise that there weren't more Irish going to Rozvadov. We obviously didn't attend ourselves, and the numbers in the main were just 768 players, which included quite a few of their ticket qualifiers, people who won small tournaments during the year. They did a thing where like maybe the top three would also get seats, that kind of thing. I think it's fair to say that maybe WSOP Europe has never really captured the imagination on this side of the Atlantic the way WSOP does in Vegas every year. Jack, maybe start with you, actually. Can you contextualize the WSOP Europe and more specifically the WSOP main, E main?
Yeah, because Jack actually just to jump in, Jack has the experience of both final tables, having made his first big splash when he final tabled the November 9, when none of us had a clue who he even was.
Yeah, well, it's obviously not very similar. In when you make Vegas final table, you know, my dad flew out, some of my friends flew out from England to attend, and you know, everyone has a huge rail. When I won WSOP Europe, I didn't have a rail. I had precisely zero people on my rail, and the guy I played heads up with had two people. So obviously, it was, you know, a bit. There were some times where they would start cheering for him. It was a bit. The atmosphere wasn't quite there. One time they cheered by accident when I won a pot, and that was the only cheering I really got during the heads up, or any time during the final table. But yeah, I mean, it's still obviously going final tabling any big tournament, you know, where there's a million or more for first is a pretty big deal, and has a lot of significance to you as the player. But I guess from the outside, you know, Rozvadov final table just seems a bit more pedestrian. Definitely, like, I mean, the WSOP in Vegas is just crazy. Like, it's like nothing else. There's no nothing compares. I mean, in terms of the actual tournament, the structure and everything, like the WSOP Europe is pretty good. Like, it's 90-minute levels from the start, and they play a lot of them, I think. So it's a really, really good structure, a lot of days. And the field is good, I would say. I think they do give out a lot of tickets, as you said, which isn't maybe as good as satellite winners, or you know, the obviously in Vegas they give tickets out to, you know, like home game winners and stuff, but there's still a very good field in Rozvadov. The main reason I'm not going now, and I want to put this out as a public statement here, like I'm not going back to Rozvadov until they reinstate my gold card. I'm absolutely fuming about this. It used to be my favorite trip every time, and I love Rozvadov. You know, I miss it. But at some point, they took away my gold card, which, for those who don't know, that means you get free room, food, alcohol. You know, the whole business. Live like a king, as the tagline goes. And you know, once you've had that experience, I just can't. I mean, I can't go back without it. It's too painful. So, you know, I don't know who owns Kings now, but if you're listening, I want you give me that gold card, I'll come every year.
Yeah, it must be an amazing feeling to both have the gold card and to actually get paid out the main event first place money. Both of those things must be lovely. Dara, GG seem to have a big say in the WSOP brand these days. What could they do to ignite more interest here? The first thing that comes to mind for me is move it around the continent.
Yeah, certainly move it because I remember WSOP Europe before it moved to Rozvadov permanently. I actually played the one in London, and that had way more hype about it, It did seem a bigger event. Obviously, still not really comparable to WSOP in Vegas. I mean, what is? But it was certainly a much bigger deal. Now it just feels like this strange sort of. It's almost like the Rozvadov final, where all of their ticket winners from, every $125 tournament that they've run during the year shows up. So as Jack said, like, that does make it a good tournament, but certainly not a prestigious one in my view. Obviously, the cream has still risen to the top consistently, apart from that year when Jack won it. But there's always going to be outliers. It nice to hear Jack too, with all of his first world problems of not having a gold card. I don't know if they've taken away his photograph either. I know he used to enjoy standing around with that in the backdrop. So.
Oh yeah, that I almost forgot about that. It was the top 10 most famous bracelet winners, and I think I edged out. Who did I? I was like one below or above Phil Ivey or something. It was like really made zero sense that ranking. I mean, even being in the top 10 was strange. I could understand if they just slipped me in at number 10. Like maybe you forget about who I passed out, but I was like number 8 or 7 or something.
I think that was a great save by you there, because I definitely interpreted that one initially as being you thinking Ivy doesn't belong in my category.
Watched up Ivy. Yeah, while we're reminiscing, I mean, Jack said he had no rail when he won it. He kind of had a virtual rail because we were railing it fairly hard.
I
Because if you remember,
remember.
David, that was the worst week we ever had in the ship race. Literally, we had about six guests lined up and they kept cancelling on us. And we were like, who the hell can we get at short notice that's done anything even remotely in the last while? And at that stage, I think Jack was down to the last two or three tables, and we were like, oh, if Jack final tables, we can bring him on. So I was pestering Jack on the final day, saying, we need you tomorrow, we need you to show up tomorrow. And fair play to him, because I do remember also that he probably had drunk an awful lot the night before after his win, presumably alone, like, because he had no rail. But we did have to postpone the interview maybe an hour or two while Jack struggle to get out of bed. So yeah, that was above and beyond from Jack.
Well, no, shout out to Henry Kilbane, who was still there. He had to stay because he was commentating on it. So I had him at least. And Michael Mrakesh, who couldn't be bothered to rail because he was too busy playing a $500, I think, Omaha freeze out or something. Maybe it was even less than that. I can't remember. But I was, yeah, I asked him to come be in a winner's photo. He's like, no, I can't miss any hands. So that was fun.
Priorities, priorities.
Yeah.
Well, look, from the WSOPE, obviously, it's not been the only big festival in recent weeks. A few weeks ago, we had the EPT in Barcelona, and then the Poker Masters was over in Vegas, and the upcoming EPT Cyprus, as you mentioned, Jack. I think it has just started today. There is lots of money and lots of titles to be won at these, but also lots of GPI rankings points. And we don't often give too much love to the GPI. So I want to do a little segment on that now. Don't know if GPI rankings is something that pricks your interest, but currently sitting at the top of the 2024 rankings, and he's been there for a record equaling now 20 weeks in a row, is future Chip Race guest Jesse Lowness. I just booked him there today, so look out for that on a future show. He's held on to top spot now thanks to three top 10 finishes in Barcelona, not far behind either him and former Chip Race guests, Adrian Mateus and Mike Watson. Actually, about 70 points separates them all, as far as I know. Lowness is a relatively new kid on the block, and he plays a brand of what he's happy to call street poker, claiming to be more of a field-based player than theory. Players like these are fewer and farther between, it seems, these days in a poker world that's more dominated by studied theory players. Dara, what do you make of Lowness's meteoric rise?
It's always hard to comment on stuff like this because, variance is so huge in tournaments, and there's obviously such a thing. There's as much positive variance as negative variance. Usually, when people talk about variance, they're talking about negative variance, and they're using it as an excuse for why they haven't done much lately. But there are people with huge positive variance, and we've all known over the course of our careers guys who've flown really high and appear to be playing a very different style from everybody else, but then they disappear when variance stops being their friend. I've never actually played with Jesse, so I can't really comment. I mean, he certainly does appear to have some, in inverted commas, life skills, which undoubtedly help him in this arena. But you know, as much as I love rankings, it's such a small sample, particularly live, that, you know, if it weren't so, the same people would be winning every year. And I mean, I know Chrissy pretty much wins female player of the year every year, but that really does indicate that she's a cut above her competition in that particular category. But yeah, it's just really difficult to say. I mean, we always have this conversation when somebody who seems to be different is running very well, and people say, you know, maybe they have a style or doing something different. I remember people made similar claims for Adam Hall a couple of years ago. So yeah, it's just, you know, I hate to sound like Phil Hellmuth, but let's see in 5 or 10 years.
Well, Jack, turning to you for an equally annoying question that maybe gets thrown at people from time to time. Choosing a best tournament player in the world right now, obviously it's a silly thing to do, but maybe humor me for a moment and tell me who you think is the best. For me, it is actually Mateos. He's someone who's been around for a lot of years, and he just seems to always be very, very special when he's playing on stream. And I think actually my hunch is he might pip Jesse by year's end. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's hard to argue against Adrian Mateos. He's always plays very well, very good and strong, hard to play against, but has no like obvious style or like league, you know, anything that you would say. Oh, if someone asks you, okay, what are some reads on Mateos? I'd be like, I mean, he just plays great. Like, there's nothing. Whereas if someone asked me for a read on Lonis, I played with him once, and I probably have a, you know, a good four or five things that you could use against him. So yeah, I mean, Mateos is just a very, very strong player. I mean, I don't know. I think that it's I don't know. I guess it's fun to think about. Maybe I could come up with like a top 10 or something, but like I hesitate to say anyone's the best, because, you know, it could, it's changing constantly as well. A lot of these guys, like, you know, they're studying so much, playing a lot, and yeah, maybe right now Mateos is the best, but maybe this, you know, Bad Ziakowski or something is just better, but like, he hasn't had any sick results in the last few months or whatever, which is pretty normal. So it's really hard to say. I think any of these top guys are just very, very good, and hard to pick amongst them. It's funny you mentioned Adamo. Actually, I think like a lot of people put him at number one when he was on a huge heater. Now he plays exactly the same, and probably no one. Well,
yeah,
you know, a lot of people were just picking someone else who's just had more results recently. One player actually I played recently was the other Australian guy, Roffelshav, Cale Burns. Yeah, I mean, I played like one hand with him, and like thought about it for like a week afterwards, because we just talked about it a bit, and I was like, wow, this guy's like on such a high level. But it was like, actually, I felt like, you know, I learned so much just from, you know, playing with him for like 20 minutes or something. So like, yeah, guys like this, always inspiring. But we'll see. Maybe in 5 years, everyone's going to be copying what Jesse Lonis is doing and saying how great he is.
Well, look, to continue to put you both on the spot, maybe Jack go first this time. You are currently 15th on the all-time UK money list in terms of live winnings. Online, I don't know where exactly you would place. If you had to give yourself an all-time UK ranking, where would you place yourself?
that is a tough question. Sorry, where did you say I am now?
13? You're 15th 50? In 50. The money list, but obviously
on
that's
the money list. Yeah.
Just a kind of a winnings live list. I know you're a winner online too, but I don't know like how you would maybe rate yourself overall when you look at, you know, UK poker down the years.
Yeah, I mean, my online winnings are mediocre at best. Like, I haven't played that much in the last few years. So if we're including online, I guess I'm probably pretty far down the list. Like, there's a lot of UK guys that play exclusively online who are probably very, very good, and would have really good results if they ever played live. So I really don't know where I would be on the UK list. I mean, top 100, hopefully. But like, you mean
who is this modest person?
I know, yeah. One downswing and the Jackson care, I'm the best at everything, and has disappeared into this pussy. Oh, I might be top 100.
Okay, well, Darren, to put you on in a similar spot here, you're also 15th on the all-time Irish money list in terms of live winnings. Online, I don't have perfect information, but in terms of all-time profit, you must be top three. You might even be number one. Where would you place yourself on an all-time Irish ranking list?
I honestly have no idea. My relatives on my father's side are laboring under the misapprehension that I'm the only great Irish poker player. So just on the off chance that they might be watching, maybe I should say number one, but they're probably not watching. So yeah, I mean, it's hard to measure. It's certainly live, I feel I've run under EV over the course of my career. But I played a lot over the course of my career. So, you know, maybe 15th is in or around the right spot. Online, I've done much more volume, obviously, and made a lot more money. But then the competition in Ireland is not particularly fierce. Like, Jack's competing with a lot of the best players in the world, online players in the world in the UK category. It's fair to say the competition in Ireland is a little bit less ferocious on that front, at least until recently. So yeah, I don't really know. I guess maybe top five online, top 20 live, maybe.
Very modest again. Well, you mentioned downswing there, from flying high in the rankings to sinking low. I do want to actually talk a little bit about downswings. I'm currently on a nice little uptick, but for a few months this summer, it was all straight down for me, and that was a very frustrating period. One trait that's very important as a poker player is the ability, I feel, to take pain. The game can be brutal and downswings can play tricks on your mind, even if you've been in the game a long time. We all know Darren can take pain because that's basically what ultra running is. How much of a masochist are you, Jack?
I think we're all pretty big masochists if we play tournaments. I spoke to a friend of mine in Vegas this year who's playing cash games. And I just asked him, like, he was saying like it wasn't going very well, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, really? You you're down for the street? No, of course I'm not down. I would never lose money. So I was like, oh, wait, you never lose money in Vegas. Yeah, no, he goes to Vegas every year. Every year wins money playing cash games. And that is the standard for cash game players. And yet, you know, the standard for tournament players is like, oh, yeah, I'm, you know, down 100 buy-ins, something like that. Like, you know, 100 of your regular binds, let's say, like, and that's just completely normal, you know. So yeah, you have to take a lot of pain if you want to be a tournament player, and you know, downswing is obviously part of life. And the way I think about tournament playing is like we're always on a downswing, because unless you won the last tournament you played, you're at least one buy-in down right now. So you know, you're always on a downswing. You're never at peak. But yeah, I mean, the question is, yeah, how long do you go before you consider it, you know, a downswing and have to actually consider doing something about it?
Yeah, Darren, I want to turn to you now about things to do when you are downswinging. And by this, I don't mean a pretty ordinary, you know, bad patch of variance, which, you know, like Jack said, we're all kind of used to and wouldn't even count it. What I more mean is like when you are having some proper, you know, free fall. Obviously, you know, if it's, you know, starting to bother you or it's starting to become an issue, I still feel like just gritting your teeth and playing through it is the best. But at a certain point, at a kind of a prolonged downswing point, it does start to get a bit more concerning. A couple of times, at least a year online, I start to feel a bit punch drunk and decide to maybe cut an online session short. I also occasionally, rarely, but occasionally decide not to re-enter a live tourney when I would normally just flick it in again. While I've undoubtedly lost some EV with those decisions, there's almost like a self-care component to waiting until I'm in a better frame of mind. Your thoughts on that and any other advice you might have?
Yeah, I think it's very personal to everybody, and I think your approach is definitely optimal for you. You definitely swing on the emotional roller coaster more than certainly I do, and maybe Jack as well. My instinct always when I'm in a downswing is just to keep going harder, and remind myself that I've been here lots of times before and I've always come through it. And the more volume I do and the more I don't let it affect my play, the faster the perceived downswing will end. I mean, Jack said we're always on a downswing, and actually his answer was kind of interesting. He said, unless you've won your last tournament. I mean, I think if I've cast my last tournament, I don't consider myself on a downswing. But then Jack fires so many bullets, he probably does need to win tournaments to actually pull ahead. But my view is there's, and I wrote about this in a piece recently, I've kind of come around to the view that there's no such thing as a downswing, really, because you can only see a downswing when you look back. You know, okay, I break my last 10 tournaments and there's nothing. But at the time you were going through that, you didn't know that you were going to break your last tournaments. When you break the first one, you didn't know you were going to break your second one or your third one or your fourth one, et cetera, et cetera. You should always be looking forward in poker, or at least staying in the present and not thinking about the past. I think even just thinking about something like downswing, it can be bad for you. I spoke about this recently in Barcelona too, when our good friend Willie Elliott kept asking me whether I was up or down for the trip. And my answer was like, I honestly don't know and I don't care. I don't want to think about that type of stuff. It's just too short a sample. You shouldn't really be thinking, because I've seen it affect people adversely in both directions. When they're on a downswing, they sort of like stop playing because they want the pain to stop, and when they're on an upswing, they stop playing because they want to go off and celebrate or do other stuff. So yeah, I it's a very boring answer, but I just don't really think about downswings at all. I think they're probably, I mean, I don't even find them that particularly difficult to deal with, because if they're happening online, well, I'm just at home and I get up every day and I still want to play and I go and play. And as I said, I don't really think about what the recent results are. I don't track. I used to, at the start of my career, have a spreadsheet and I put in all my account balances at the end and I see whether it was going up or down. But I'm far too lazy to do that these days. So I don't even do that. And certainly when you're playing live, like exactly like Jack said, when you're at a live event, you're just there, you're showing up and you're just playing. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about, rather than whether I break my last three or four tournaments.
Well, Jack, back to you on this. Like, as one of the game's, I suppose, legendary sunrunners, is how I might put it. Can you relate to even the idea of downswinging at all? And can you relate to the emotional turmoil that it can bring on occasion?
Well, yeah, I mean, I want to talk quickly about what Dara just said, because it was quite interesting. The idea of like not even being aware of downswings is like ignoring them so much. It's a typical viewpoint of someone that is very overrolled for their games. It sounds like Dara is playing...
Rich person problems.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like Dara is playing stakes that are so low that like you could go on a really, really prolonged downswing and it won't affect your life in any way, which is a good thing. But I think probably if someone was watching this hoping for some sort of advice and, you know, and they're in some soul-crushing downswing when they're worried they're going to have to mortgage their house or something, then... probably not the most useful advice to just say, like, you know, just grind it out and keep going. You know, I think that sort of points to a direction of a pretty common sense solution, which is to drop stakes to the point where they no longer matter. Like, and, you know, as dumb as it will feel, like, that's gonna, you know, as long as it's something that's at least somewhat worth playing and keep going, then like, you know, get your confidence back, get keep in the ring, so to speak. If that's what you want to do. I mean, I think also taking breaks is a valid strategy. And like, if your downswing is affecting your mental state to the point where you're playing badly and like, or like not enjoying playing, which, you know, to me is a bit, to me matters, you know, like I don't want to be like sitting there grinding, like hating life. But I think taking breaks is pretty valid as well. But yeah, if you're going to grind through it, like it has to be, you can't be putting your real life bankroll at risk, like your, you know, the money you need to live, sort of thing.
I think that's really nice advice, but I also heard in that an almost a dare to Dara to go play the Triton Circuit all the time. Is that right?
Yeah, that makes sense. Like you should be playing some stakes that like at least will give you the chance to move you to like a much higher level, right? You should shot take in spots where you can actually really increase your life EV by having a big score, right? Like if you're always playing tournaments where like the top prize just doesn't change anything, and you know, losing 100 in a row also doesn't change anything, like you're never going to have that one score where that takes you into the stratosphere. But having said that, like nowadays, like there's so many, you know, steps and huge playouts for tiny binds and stuff, I think you can pretty much like keep playing very low and still have those opportunities. But like, I think it makes sense to occasionally, you know, play some higher stuff and go for a big win. I've completely forgotten the question you actually asked me.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things in there. I mean, Jack's right in the sense that definitely, like, at the start of my career, when I was really sweating the money, downswings definitely hurt more. It was still kind of my attitude just to grind through them and try not to think about them. But it was certainly a lot more difficult. And, you know, it's not just the stakes that I play, but also I have, you know, I've made a lot of money over the course of my career online. So that kind of acts as a buffer as well. And then I obviously have other income streams these days as well. So I'm definitely, I'm not sweating the money in any real sense, but like, I don't want to either. I mean, I don't want to risk losing everything that I've spent 15 years building up slowly on a couple of shots at a Triton. Also, I think you have to bear in mind, I'm definitely not typical. Most guys are like Jack. They started at a young age. They could pretty much swing for the fences, and if it didn't go to plan, that was fine. You know, I started in my 40s. I was supporting a family already. The idea of like going bust and having to tell my family, okay, we're going to have to move out of the house now and go live. that definitely wasn't very appealing to me. And to be honest, still isn't appealing. You know, even at this stage, like, I think losing it all when you're 20 or 25 is fine because you can just rebuild again. Losing it all as you move into your 60s and going to have to tell your wife that we lost the house because Jack told me to play a few Tritons.
Hey, I never said you should play Tritons. that was never.
It was implied, Jack. It was definitely implied.
That was inference. That was completely unfounded. I was suggesting you play like a 1K on your own roll or something, like, you know, like a soft 1K. Somewhere like not or like, you know, EPT main, just sell a little bit. Like, I'm not saying just run 500K in a Triton series.
Yeah, I think you might be. I mean, I know every time you run into me, I'm probably jumping into some Nike 100 Turbo. But I did actually play the last EPT main completely on my own roll. Didn't sell a single piece, and I do routinely play 1Ks. But yeah, no desire to really go 25K or 50K level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but like, yeah, I also like 500 and 1Ks online, I guess, would be the other way for you to shot take. But yeah, I mean, all of these things are playable with satellites, which I believe you're kind of okay at, so like that might help you quite a lot. But anyway, this isn't like a personal coaching session for you, Dara. I'm thinking about the guys out there, you know, they tuned in, they want to hear some real advice. And I do have one last piece of advice for the downswing bros, which is to get coaching. Like if you're in a big downswing, like 1 hour of coaching would just like completely change everything. Because if you show someone, you know, get like a real piece of you playing, you know, best way in my opinion is to record screen of you playing, so you can't like hide anything. Like for an hour, get someone to watch it, and like they'll tell you if you're downswinging because you're unlucky or you're just bad. And like, that's the most important piece of information that you can get when you're on a downswing. It's like, am I actually making more, you know, am I playing bad or am I just running super bad? So that's my last thought on the downswing subject.
No, that is great advice. And I think probably best to leave it there before Moreo Carney takes out a hit on you, Jack. Look, the best advice I can give is to focus on the things that you can control. I suppose that's just sort of there in what you've both been saying. Do a bit of extra study, put in the extra reps on your favorite poker trainer. I like DTO for that. Be process oriented rather than results oriented. Always good advice as a tournament poker player, especially. Stay composed and stay rational. Get back on the horse as well, as Dara said. I think it's you know, always possible to ride variants out. Maybe not in the live setting at sort of the big field stuff, you know, they always kind of end up being shots, but certainly when you get back to online or you play maybe your average buy-in live as well. Anyway, actually, I want to segue, this kind of neatly segues to study to play ratio. Dara, we've spoken plenty in the last while on the subject of study. I think it's come up in numerous pieces, but I noticed you wrote a piece for your new site, Simplify Poker, just a few days ago that was specifically about studying to playing ratio. What do you recommend, and does it change based on the standard of the player, the frequency with which they play, or even maybe some individual traits that they might have?
Yeah, I think I think it is personal for everyone, and actually that whole area of thought was kickstarted by a discussion I had with Jack, I believe, in Cyprus last year, where he actually gave, unusually for Jack, very good thoughts and advice on this whole area about how, like, at different stages of your career you should be playing different amounts. I think at the start of players' careers, like when we start, we learn by playing. And there's still a lot of people that's an effective way to do. But then for a lot of people, it's a lot tougher online, particularly these days. And if you're trying to learn by playing, you can lose money very, very quickly. So if you're that kind of player who's just losing, I would suggest that you really have to shift the focus to study at the start, just to make yourself a winning player. And there are a number of players I've coached who've been in that role, exactly in that position, where they're just losing and they're not really getting better fast enough that they can afford to keep losing at the same rate. So they kind of go off, they do some study, they get some coaching, then they come back and now they're break even or maybe even winning. And this is the point where they can start learning by reps. So at the start of your career, it really depends on which of those camps you fall into. As you go through your career, funnily enough, I had a detailed discussion with a student last night on a session. He had an amazing first 6 months and now he's on a bit of a downswing. And he was asking exactly the same thing. And a couple of points came up during the discussion, which was like, it depends on the level of opposition you're playing against. Like if you're playing Tritons, you're going to have to study. I mean, there's no way around it. And most of your focus will have to be study. And that kind of fits in with, like, if you're just playing high rollers where you're only playing 3 or 4 days a week, then the rest of the time you can study and you should be studying. You absolutely have to be. I remember hearing in Nottingham a few years ago, Dee Peters' girlfriend telling us that when he's not playing, he's just basically studying 14, 15, 16 hours a day. And he only plays 3 or 4 days a month, typically, you know, the high roller circuit, or at least that was the case at the time. So for those guys, they have to do 80-20. But if you're playing very soft live field tournaments like we are doing, then the equation is slightly different, because, you know, we could study really, really hard and maybe it only adds 2 or 3% to our ROI. And all the time that we're spending studying, we could be playing these soft 1Ks where maybe our expectation is already very high. So I think for that type of player, it makes sense maybe for it to be 80% play, 20% study. But at the same time, you do want to keep some amount of studying, because, you know, Powell once said that all political careers end in failure, typically a lost election. Most poker careers end when you're just not a winning player anymore, and it takes you a while to realize it, and you have to lose a bunch of money before you do realize it, or maybe all your money, and then that just puts you out of the game. So you want to kind of get ahead of that. You don't want the game to pass you by. So I think at a very minimum, as a professional, you should be studying 20%. Then if you're a recreational, the equation is completely different. Like if you're just a rich recreational who enjoys playing and just doesn't want to be terrible, just wants to be competitive, then you just have to put in whatever amount of time that takes. That might only be an hour a week with a coach or watching some content. So yeah, I think it is very different for everybody, and there's actually quite a lot to think about: the level of your competition, the levels you're playing at, what your schedule is, what your goals are, what your current level is. All that stuff plays into it.
Great advice, Jack. Dara mentioned there that the idea for this article he wrote kind of came out of a conversation he had with you. What is your study to play ratio?
Yeah, so at this point, I guess I study a lot more than I play. Because I will go to a trip, I don't know, something like 1 week a month, I guess, on average, and maybe a little higher because of Vegas. And during those trips, you play every day, obviously. But in between trips, I will study most days. So the ratio is pretty high in favor of studying. And my general thought on this, to begin with, the reason I said that you should mostly play at the start and mostly study, or the ratio should increase in favor of studying as you continue, is more to do with just how you'll be able to process the studying. And in my opinion, if you're a complete beginner, it's impossible to become a winning player through study alone. Like I would argue, or near impossible. Like it's something akin to trying to learn how to swim by watching videos on on how to swim, like instructions. Like you can have all the knowledge of the different ways of doing it, but if you're not actually in the pool, you're not going to learn to swim. But of course, you know, as you get, once you've been in the pool a bit and you can keep your head up and swim about a bit, maybe with a little instruction at the time, you're already going to be beating the lowest stakes at that point. You know, like the equivalent of beating like 1 cent, 2 cent online is like being able to keep your head above water in swimming. Maybe this is a bad analogy because I think you actually do need to be taught how to swim at some point when you first get in. I'm not sure if you picked that up naturally, but anyway, point is, like, I think that as a beginner, you have to just get time in playing, because otherwise your brain won't learn the patterns of the game in a way where you can like then add the study to it. So in other words, like if I tell my wife, you know, like, oh yeah, on Ace High Rainbow Boards, you should see about this, you know, frequency or whatever. She's not gonna like have a sort of framework of playing to put that into action. And the next time that comes up, by that time she'll have forgotten about it. Whereas if you played for, you know, 1,000 to 5,000, 10,000 hours, like I can see something very specific about very, you know, niche part of the game, and I'm gonna remember it the next time it comes up because I already have that experience of being in those situations. So yeah, that's my opinion on studying. Like, you know, if you're at an elite level, like you could probably just study for like 2, 3 months without ever playing a hand and then be much better. But if you're a beginner, you can study 2, 3 months and like most of the stuff you studied is just gonna fall out of your brain and you won't remember any of it, or very little of it. So I think as you're improving at poker, like obviously I think that the important thing is just not to go into like a study cave if you're a beginner. And like if you want to study, then obviously study, but then take that and start playing and try and apply it almost as quickly as possible, in my opinion. I think that's the best way to do it.
That's great advice, some really nice insights. And I think the analogy does work overall, you know, with the swimming. I think it is about keeping your head above water to begin with and then sort of learning the strokes. Okay, so finally, our final topic of today, I want to talk about what I think is perhaps the biggest scandal in the poker world for a long, long time. Unfortunately, the way technology has gone, this one was probably about as predictable as a sexual harassment allegation against Nick Fertucci. I'm talking, of course, about the Bot Farm Corporation story, which did actually develop in a surprising and worrying direction. I'll try and go into it. Maybe a quick summary will help. Give me a chance to do that. A couple of weeks ago, Kit Shillelagh wrote a piece for Bloomberg about a Russian company going by the name Bot Farm Corp. It was a company that emerged from a group of Siberian students in a town called Omsk who built some state-of-the-art, for their time at least, poker bots, deployed them on sites, sold them to others who used them, later sought funding for their company. I think they underwent a merger at one point with another bunch of bot-making students from Russia, and eventually they struck a deal with a casino executive from Michigan called David Fairlam, whose objective was to find a commercial use for their tech and their products that they could make in the US. Their bot actually won a poker bot prize back in 2013, defeating highly rated bots from Carnegie Mellon and University of Alberta. They're the famous ones people can think of, the Liberatus and Cloudico. They're the guys who built all those ones. However, the US company that was built around this tech, this Russian tech, known as Neo Poker Labs, ultimately wound down, and the Bot Farm Corp sort of returned to the shadows, if you like, from where they redeveloped and repurposed their tech to create tools to help online sites, this is kind of ironic, to help online sites detect bots, and later then developed house bots, which they offered to sites to provide fake liquidity where none organically existed. Now, this is where Jonathan Raab, our good pal, comes in here. And his article, written a few days after the Kit Shillelagh article, Johnny actually came to me with the majority of these findings way back in April of this year. He was very concerned when he found out what he was unearthing, if you like. A company called Jack Poker, which he had been tasked to review in his role as editor of a poker affiliate site, PokerWired, was deploying house bots in the thousands. He witnessed it firsthand while playing on the site, and a detailed subsequent investigation, which involved lots of internet sleuthing by Johnny found links between Jack Poker and this Russian bot company, this original one. He also discovered links between a subsidiary of Bot Farm Corp and 8 other poker sites, including Club GG and Poker Bros. The idea that house bots are already being deployed in the poker ecosystem is obviously a huge, huge concern. Jack, what did you make of this story?
Yeah, well, as you said, not a huge surprise. I guess the only surprise really is the extent of it, and just how there's so many. The house bots thing is crazy. I never really considered this as a use case, that the site would just have like 90% of its traffic be bots, and they're just basically like they're kind of bum hunting depositors to like come in and play a bit and then lose their money and leave, right? It's like, it's almost like a new school bum hunting technique, which I'd never thought of before. And I believe they said that they were adjusting the skill level of the bots to sort of match the players, which is kind of interesting. And I think that they think that it's like ethical or something, like basically for a amateur player to log on, play against bots that are sort of at their level, so they're not getting sharked by pros, and then they will, I mean, they still lose their money obviously, because the casino isn't going to exactly let them beat the bots, but it feel, you know, it doesn't, it feels kind of fair. They're not getting completely destroyed, so they keep playing for longer, and then I guess pay more rake because they're not just getting all their money scooped up immediately. They're sort of like cycling through it a bit, I guess. Pretty impressive, impressive levels of shadiness. I guess that was just the Jack Poker. I mean, all the sites apart from Club GG and Poker Bros, I'd never heard of all the other ones. So good reason not to play on random sites that you never heard of, especially if they offer too good to be true deposit bonuses. Sort of seems like a I mean, you guys have these at Unibet or no? Is that
certainly not? We absolutely do not. We actually take quite a firm stance even against the idea of stables. I remember our head of poker, Chris Birkvall, coming to me and saying that he was approached on numerous occasions over the years by stables, whether they wanted to provide liquidity that way. That's obviously a way that sites have looked to have, you know, liquid games. And we've always turned that down because we just never wanted to enter into those relationships where we offered better rake back deals or whatever was being requested by them. And they did sometimes, I remember he said to me, they did sometimes like deploy their stable in our Hexabro pool or in our maybe a couple of different MTTs pool for a week, knowing that it would boost our numbers and we would notice and go, oh, we've had a great week in them, and then come in with the phone call going, hey, have you noticed your numbers are better on these? Well, it's because I brought in my stable. Would you like that to be a regular thing? And we've always said no, which I think is great because it protects the ecosystem. And even though there is always a liquidity argument to be made about the benefit of these kinds of things, and I get the liquidity argument, absolutely do. When it's not organic like that, and then I think can lead to kind of dependent relationships on those things, and obviously with these bots, it's taking it another step further, removing the middleman completely, if you will. Dara, it seems to me like the grift goes something like this. Players are fooled into thinking that a site's actually a vibrant place with juicy prize pools and the prospect of overlays, where in fact they're being pitted against these bots versus whom they've basically got no chance because they've been designed to give them no chance. The bots are actually tailored to their skill levels, which, you know, like Jack alluded to, they're industry people, and there are a few of them out there say is better because, you know, you're not playing against real people. So you'll lose your money more gradually, perhaps, and get more fun out of your deposit, thus encouraging more redeposits. Bear in mind, though, if that person improves, they won't start breaking even or even, you know, getting to the point where they win, because they'll just, you know, level up on the bots against them. So, you know, it's kind of a hopeless endeavor for a player who's looking to get better. In the same way, winning players who come onto these sites will immediately lose too, because they will have the top class, the better bots deployed against them. They'll very quickly get discouraged. They won't even end up in player pools with real people, most likely. they'll get discouraged, they'll leave, and therefore there isn't even a human player in the ecosystem to take what little sliver we human players even take out of the game compared to the huge amount that the sites ultimately get. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I actually think a lot of people who work in the online poker industry just really don't understand this fundamentally. Like, I've heard the argument advanced recently, for example, that, you know, why not have bots? Losing players don't care who they're losing to. In fact, they might even prefer to lose to a bot than to a human. Like, I've never met these recreational players who are quite happy to lose their money to bots. One of the things I hear the most often when I'm trying to get people to play online is, oh, you don't know who you're playing against. You could be playing against bots, et cetera, et cetera. People, this is not, you know, we're not embracing our new robot overlords here and just happy to give them all our money. I think people, even if they are losing players, they like to be playing against other humans. That's just a general thing. You know, I play a bit of chess online as well. You always have the option when you go on one of the chess sites to play against the computer or to play against a human. I think the vast majority of people play against another human, even though, you know, maybe from a leveling up perspective it might be better to play against a computer, but I don't think that's not the motivation. And poker in particular is just a very human game. Like, the whole game is based around social interaction, human interaction, all of this stuff. So I just don't really see any argument at all for bots beyond I have a failing poker site, we can't get enough people to legitimate means, so let's pile a bunch of bots on there and create the illusion that we have a properly functioning site. I just don't see it as the future. It's a problem, it's not the future.
Really well said. Jack, let's finish with you, actually. I was very happy to see the Only Friends podcast, Berkey's podcast, cover this story on their episode last night. And I actually did chime in at one point via the chat to sort of point out something that I think was being missed in their conversation, although it was a good conversation. Jesse Sylvia was their guest and he was very good on the show. And it was basically revolved around the idea of trust. Like, I think a big problem with all of this is that the incentives are all wrong now from the house's point of view. Usually in poker, they provide an RNG, likely gets verified by eCogra or whoever, and they just get the rake and they get the reg fees. And then it doesn't matter, just let the chips fall where they may. Players will win pots and lose pots. It's so vital, though, I think, in our game, the idea that if you lose, if you get two outed, for example, that a person won your money, like that happened, just psychologically, the way so many poker players are wired. It's going to be very hard, I think, for poker players to accept that an RNG is legit, even if it is legit, with a company who actually profit from their in-house bots, right?
Yeah, I mean, if they're going to go down that route, then yeah, it makes sense that, like, why would the RNG not help them as well, right? Favor the bot in some way. I guess the only argument against that is, like, maybe it's a lot easier to program a real RNG than, or at least, you know, a functioning or one, an even one, than one that, like, specifically favors the bots. But I don't really know if that's true or not. But yeah, I mean, I obviously, if a poker site has its own bots playing against you, then you can't trust anything. I mean, you can't trust that they're not just going to take your money and kick you out for some, you know, trumped up reason that they discover, oh, you did this, oh yeah, you're out. That's we don't allow that sort of thing. You know, I mean, anything can happen. I mean, you've got to be really careful playing on these unlicensed sites, the small site, you know, all this sort of stuff. I mean, sad thing is, like, probably, like, you know, online poker is just slowly going to become less and less of a thing, and we're all just going to have to play live tournaments, or it's just all going to be bounty tournaments. But it's just going to be all some kind of bounty tournament, which the bots haven't solved yet. And, you know, that they freak out when you know, they don't know how to calculate bounties or something. And that's probably the main way to go on if you're going to play online. I mean, you'd be kind of crazy to play cash games online now, I think, on these sites. Unless you just, you know, think you're better than the bots, I guess, which I've heard that view being espoused. Like, yeah, if you're going to play, like, PLO or something, like, oh yeah, I'm just going to grind against the bots, I don't care, like, that sort of thing. I've heard people say that. But there's also, you know, the bots could have two bots on the same table, and then you're really screwed if they're sharing cards.
Good
so
point.
Yeah, I mean, like, online cash games pretty much dying, I guess. And Maybe they can't handle Zoom very well. Maybe it's too fast. I don't know. Like, there's probably ways to get her to like limit the effectiveness of bots. And then yeah, the only other way is to just like really go overboard on the security teams, which you know it's always good, but there's probably not going to be that many sites that really keep up with that to such a high level. And yeah, and also people just love playing on these on the sites with the biggest guarantees. So like if they're gonna get that by bots, they're just gonna do that. I mean that's how they win, right?
Yeah, really well said, and really good analysis of it all. I really appreciate your take on that one. Obviously, it's a story that Dara and I have weighed in on and will continue to weigh in on, I think, a little bit more over the next few weeks and maybe on future episodes too. It doesn't feel like a story that's going to go away. On that depressing note, that's it for this episode of The Lock-In. It remains for me to thank our guest, Jack Sinclair.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on, Jack. Thank you so much. And Dara, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Yeah, and just a final plug for anybody who is interested in that in that bot story. The man who's very much leading it, as you said, John Rabb, is coming to Dublin in a few weeks to talk at the Edge Expo. He's leading up a workshop on basically, are we all screwed because of the bots? So that will be I think that will be available online afterwards. So if you want to educate yourself more fully than just our three opinions, that's definitely something to check out.
Yeah, well said, Dara. A huge shout out there to Johnny Rabb. Kitchell obviously wrote the first article that was published, but I know Johnny was working on this for 6 months before he published any of his own findings, and he has very much been the whistleblower on the aspect of this story, which has been about the in-house bots. And I think the industry owes him a huge debt of gratitude for that, and I hope he gets considered to be the hero he kind of is for his work in this field so far. And yeah, it looked great that he's speaking at Edge. It sounds like it'll be a great contribution to that expo. Good night, everybody. Thank you.